Chapter 54. Yao. What's wrong with this one now? Is she sick? Why is she dabbing at her face like that? Masha's accent, usually just a flavor, sounded more pronounced than usual to Yao. Yao's parents were the same. They sounded extra Chinese when they were stressed about their internet service or health. He should call his parents. You are wasting your life with this woman, his mother had said the last time they talked. Yao, said Masha. She had sat down in the chair vacated by Delilah and was looking up at him, her big green eyes so worried and vulnerable. She was rarely vulnerable. It was exquisite torture to see her so. Francis is menopausal, said Yao. Masha shuddered. Is she? Yao knew Masha was a similar age to Francis, also in her 50s, but she was presumably not experiencing any symptoms of menopause. Masha was a puzzle Yao could never quite solve. She enjoyed discussing the most intimate intricacies of the digestive system. She had no shame when it came to nudity. Why would she? And often walked about naked when there were no guests on the property. But the word menopause caused her to shudder, as if something so distasteful could never happen to her. Yao looked at the back of Marsha's neck and saw a small inflamed lump, a mosquito bite. It was strange to see any form of blemish on her beautiful body. She reached back with her hand and scratched it. You're making it bleed, he said. He put his hand over hers. She waved him away irritably. Delilah is taking a long time, he said. Delilah is gone, said Masha, her eyes on the screen. Yes, she went to get you tea, said Yao. No, she is gone, said Masha. She's not coming back. What are you talking about? Masha sighed. She looked up at him. Have you not worked it out yet? Delilah looks after Delilah. She turned back to the screen. You can go too, if you like. I will take responsibility for it all. The new protocol was my idea, my decision. She could never have applied the new protocol without his medical expertise. If anyone should pay, it was Yao. I'm not going anywhere, he said, no matter what happens. Over a year ago now, Masha had come across an article about microdosing in Silicon Valley. White-collar professionals were using microdoses of LSD to increase their productivity, alertness, and creativity. Microdosing was also being used with some success to treat mental illnesses like anxiety and depression. Masha was fascinated in her typical Masha way. Yao loved her sudden, wild enthusiasms and the fearless way she strode into unfamiliar territory. She tracked down the person who wrote that first article and phoned him. That's what led to her learning about psychedelic therapy, where people were given full doses of psychedelic drugs. Within a very short time, she became obsessed. She ordered books online. She made more phone calls to experts all around the world. This was the answer, she said. This was what would take them to the next level. Psychedelic therapy, she said, was the magic shortcut to enlightenment. Scans showed that the brain activity of someone who had taken psilocybin bore striking similarities to the brain of an experienced meditator during deep meditation. At first, Yao had just laughed in disbelief. He had no interest. When he was a paramedic, he had seen the terrible impact of illegal drugs. The man who had held a knife to his throat had been suffering the psychotic effects of crystal meth. Yao had treated junkies. They were not a good advertisement for the wonderful effects of drugs. But Marcia chipped away at him, day by day. "You're not listening. This is nothing like that," she said. "Would you not use penicillin because of heroin?"
"Penicillin does not affect brain chemistry."
"Okay then, what about antidepressants, antipsychotics?" That low, persuasive, accented voice in his ear, those green eyes fixed on his, that body, that beautiful hold she had over him.
"At least study the research," she said.
So he did. He learned about the government-approved clinical trials of psychedelic drugs being used to help ease the anxiety of patients with terminal cancer. The results were overwhelmingly positive. So, too, were similar trials with war veterans suffering PTSD. Yao became curious and intrigued. Eventually, he agreed to try the therapy himself. Delilah got the supplies on the dark web, including the drug testing kits. Yao did all the testing. He and Delilah both agreed to be the guinea pigs. Marcia would be the psychedelic therapist. She herself, because of her medical history, could not do the therapy, but that was fine because she had already had transcendent experiences through her meditation and her famous near-death experience. The psychedelic therapy had been, as Marcia promised, transformative. Even if medicating the guests turned out to be a mistake, he would never regret that. It started with a journey down a tunnel that was possibly a water slide, but the water was not wet, which was a brilliant idea, that ultimately spat him out in a cinema, where he sat on a red velvet seat and ate buttery popcorn while he watched as his whole life was played back to him, frame by frame, from the moment of his birth, right through school and university, up until the moment he arrived at Tranquillum House. Except that he didn't just watch it happen. He re-experienced every incident, every failure, every success. And this time around, he'd understood everything. He understood that he'd loved Bernadette, his fiancée, more than she'd ever loved him, and that she was never going to be the right woman for him. He understood that his parents had never been suited to each other either. He understood that he had the wrong personality to be a paramedic. He was depleted rather than energized by bursts of adrenaline. Most significant of all, he learned that his phobia about mistakes had begun when he was a child. It was an incident he was sure he had never heard about from his parents or remembered before, but under the influence of psychedelic drugs, he re-experienced it in vivid detail. He was no more than 2 or 3 years old, in the kitchen of their old house. His mother briefly left the room, and he thought to himself, "I know, I'll help do the stirring." And he'd carefully pulled a chair over to the stove, and he was so pleased with himself that he'd worked out this smart solution. He'd climbed up on the chair, and he was about to reach out to the bubbling saucepan when his mother came back into the kitchen and shouted at him so loudly, and his heart leapt out of his chest, and he fell from the chair into endless space, and his mother caught him and shook him so hard his teeth chattered. He understood at last that he had internalized his mother's terror at her mistake, not his. Delilah, who refused to reveal much about her own experiences, had been unimpressed by Yao's revelations. "So it's your mother's fault. You're a nervous Nelly. Because she saved you from being scolded. What a terrible mother. No wonder you're so damaged, Yao." Yao ignored her. Sometimes Delilah seemed angry with him. He did not know why, and he didn't care, because the day after his psychedelic therapy, he woke dizzy with a new freedom. The freedom to make mistakes. Perhaps this was his first mistake. He looked at the screen showing 9 people who did not look to be transformed in any way. They looked tired, agitated, and angry. They were meant to be out by now, beginning the next stage of their rebirth. The codebreaker puzzle should have taken an hour at most. It was meant to be a fun, stimulating group activity to help them bond as a group. Back in Marsha's corporate days, she'd once been on a team-building retreat where they'd done a similar exercise and everyone had loved it. She said that people had come out of the room laughing and high-fiving each other. Marsha said she had come up with something sophisticated, subtle, and symbolic that would integrate perfectly with their psychedelic experiences. "Never afraid to blow her own trumpet, is she?" Delilah had said to Yao. Yao had put it down to jealousy. What woman wouldn't be jealous of Marsha? Yao had worried that it was perhaps too subtle. But what did it matter? The code-breaking wasn't integral to their transformations. If the guests couldn't break the code within the hour, they would let them out and lead them straight to the dining room for platters of fresh fruit and organic, sugar-free hot chocolate for breakfast. Yao had been looking forward to that part, imagining how everyone's faces would light up as he, Marsha, and Delilah triumphantly entered the dining room, plates aloft. People would clap, he'd thought. Yao had eaten a nectarine after his own psychedelic therapy session, and he could still remember the sensation of his teeth sinking into that sweet flesh. Once they'd eaten, the group was to share what they'd learned through their experiences. After that, beautiful hard-bound journals would be handed out so that everyone could write down how they planned to integrate what they'd learned about themselves into their lives back home. But nothing was going according to plan. It felt like it had first gone off track with Heather's unexpected question, "Have you been medicating us?" Which meant that Marsha's presentation of the treatment had begun on a defensive note, although she'd responded brilliantly, even under attack. People had got so angry, as if they truly believed something sinister was going on, when this was all for their benefit. Yao had checked and rechecked the dosages, the possible side effects, the guests' medical histories, their daily blood tests. There should have been only positive outcomes. He had checked everyone's vital signs throughout the night. Nothing had gone wrong. There had been no unexpected side effects. Napoleon had become agitated, but Yao had given him a dose of lorazepam, and he'd calmed down. It was true that the therapy side of it, from Yao's perspective at least, had been a little clunky. There was a disappointing banality to some of the insights the guests experienced, especially when compared to his own transcendent revelations. But Marcia had been thrilled. After all the guests had fallen asleep, she'd locked the door of the meditation studio, flushed with success. They had not imagined this. As the time had passed, both Yao and Delilah had begun to say, "I think we should let them out," or give them a clue. But Marcia was convinced that they would work it out. "This is essential to their rebirthing," she'd said. "They need to fight their way out like a baby squeezes its way out of the birth canal." Delilah had made a small sound, like a cough or a snort. "We have given them so many hints," Marcia kept saying. "Surely they are not so stupid." The problem was that the longer they left them locked up, the hungrier and angrier and stupider they got. "Even if they do work it out," said Yao now, "I think their primary emotion will still be anger." "You may be right," said Marcia. She shrugged. "We may need to be more creative going forward. Let us see what happens." Yao saw himself on that chair, his small, pudgy hand reaching for the pot of boiling water. "Look," said Marcia. She pointed at the screen. "Finally, we have progress." Chapter 55. Francis and Tony sat next to each other in companionable silence. Most people were sitting now, except for Napoleon, who paced constantly. No one was attempting to decode the security lock of the cellar door. Someone hummed, "Twinkle, twinkle, little star." Francis thought it was Napoleon. She sang the words in her head along with him. "Up above the world so high, like a diamond in the sky." She thought of the night of the starlight meditation, and her sleigh ride across the starry sky with Gillian. Lars had been singing "Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds" before. That was the song that had been playing when she first lay down on the stretcher. She mentally listed the other songs that had played through the headphones. Vincent, "When You Wish Upon a Star," Beethoven's "Moonlight Sonata." They all related to stars, or the sky, or the moon. What had Marcia said last night? Something like, "All your life you've been looking down. You have to look up." "I think we're meant to look up," she said. She got to her feet. "What?" Lars propped himself up on his elbows. "Look up where?" "All the songs were about stars and the moon and the sky," she said, "and Marcia said that we have to look up." The younger ones caught on first. Zoe, Ben, and Jessica leapt to their feet and began to walk around the room, craning their necks to study the vaulted stone ceiling with curved wooden rafters. The older ones followed more slowly and warily. "What do you think we're looking for?" asked Napoleon. "I don't know," said Francis. After a moment, she said sadly, Maybe I'm wrong. There, Heather pointed. See? Do you see? I see it, said Jessica. Frances followed her gaze. I don't actually see anything, she said. My eyesight is terrible. It's a sticker, said Tony. A sticker of a gold star. What good is a sticker? Asked Carmel. There's something above the sticker on the rafter there, said Zoe. It's a package, said Napoleon. I still can't see it, said Francis. It's wrapped up in brown paper. Heather took Francis's hand and pointed it up to the ceiling, trying to get her to look in the right direction. It's jammed into the little triangle where the two rafters meet, camouflaged against the wood. Oh, yes, I see it, said Francis, although she didn't. Okay, so let's get it down, said Jessica to Ben. Lift me up onto your shoulders. I'm not lifting you up. You're pregnant, said Ben. You're possibly pregnant. Lift me up, Dad, said Zoe to her father. You're the tallest. I don't think we'd get enough height. Napoleon tilted his head back, considering the distance. Even if you stood on my shoulders, you wouldn't reach it. The obvious thing to do is throw something up to knock it down, said Lars. I'll jump up and knock it down, said Tony. He looked up at the rafter with a gleam in his eye. I just need a couple of you guys to give me leverage. You cannot possibly jump that high, said Francis. I got the mark of the year 3 times in a row, said Tony. I don't know what the mark of the year means, but that's impossible, said Francis. It was like a joke to think of someone jumping that high. You'll injure yourself. Tony looked at her. Have you ever watched a game of Aussie rules in your life, Francis? I understand that you leap about energetically. Seriously, said Lars, we just need to throw something up there. Dislodge it from the rafters. We leap about, repeated Tony as if to himself. We leap about energetically? It's very impressive leaping, said Frances. She remembered how she'd made the mistake of scoffing when Henry had started talking about how he wanted to learn to hang glide at the age of 50. All her friends had shaken their heads. Oh, Francis, you never tell a man in the middle of a midlife crisis that he can't do something. Henry did 3 months of hang gliding lessons and suffered a chronic hip injury before he felt he'd proved his point. My highest mark ever was close to 12 feet. Tony looked up at the rafter. I can reach that. No problem. Off the back of that Collingwood player, right? Said Heather. Jimmy Moyes? Napoleon and I were at that game. Napoleon recited. The leap into heaven, into fame, into legend. Then the fall back to earth. Guernseyed Icarus. To the whistle shrill tweet. Is that a poem about football? Asked Francis. It is, Francis, said Napoleon in a teacherly way. It's called The High Mark by Bruce Dawe. It's about how the mark is the manifestation of the human aspiration to fly. It's really lovely, said Francis. Oh, my God, could we leave the poetry and the football and maybe just focus on getting out of here? Said Lars as he picked up an empty water bottle, aimed it like a javelin, and threw it up towards the ceiling. It hit the rafter and bounced back again. I'll get that parcel, said Tony, and his chest swelled and his shoulders went back like a superhero emerging from a telephone box. Chapter 56. Yao. What are they doing? Asked Marcia. I think Tony is going to try to launch off their backs like he's in a game of football, said Yao worriedly. That's crazy, said Marcia. He's too heavy. He will hurt them. They're hungry and tired, said Yao. They're not thinking straight. It's so obvious what they should do, said Marcia. Yes, said Yao. Lars had the right idea. Why are they not building a simple human pyramid? Said Marcia. Yao looked at her to see if she was serious. They are just not that smart, said Marcia. This is the problem we face, Yao. They are not smart people. Chapter 57. Francis. Napoleon and Ben had positioned themselves beneath the rafter, their heads lowered, their bodies tensed. Should we jump at the same time? Suggested Napoleon. Give you more height? No, said Tony. Just stand still. I don't think this is such a good idea, said Carmel. It's a ludicrous idea, said Lars. Now that you mention it, began Heather. But it was too late. Tony ran from the doorway at full pace. He leaped up vertically, one knee dug into Napoleon's back, the other into Ben's shoulder. For a fraction of a second, Francis saw the young man within the old. The athlete he'd once been was there in the length of his body and the resolve in his eyes. He got up there, impossibly high. He was going to do it. What a hero! One hand slapped the rafter, but then he crashed to the floor on his side with an almighty thud. Napoleon and Ben staggered in opposite directions, muffling curses. That wasn't at all predictable, sighed Lars. Tony sat up, cradling one elbow, his face as white as toothpaste. Frances got onto her knees next to him to be supportive, even though her knees crunched. Are you okay? I'm fine, he said through gritted teeth. I think I just dislocated my shoulder. Francis's stomach turned at the sight of his shoulder protruding at a strange, distressing angle. Don't move it, said Heather. No, said Tony, I need to move it. It's going to pop back in when I move it. He moved his arm. There was an audible pop. Francis toppled in a dead faint, straight into his lap. Chapter 58. Zoe. Zoe's poor dad clutched his back where he'd just borne the entire weight of one smiley Hogburn. She was kind of surprised that her mother had allowed that little exercise to go ahead. Maybe it was the drugs, or her crazy fury over the drugs, or maybe it was just that she and her dad were starstruck by meeting an AFL legend. Sorry, everyone, said Tony. Last night I dreamed I was playing again. This felt like it would be easy. He gently patted poor Frances on the cheek. Wake up, lady writer. Frances sat up self-consciously from Tony's lap and pressed a single fingertip to the center of her forehead. She looked around her.
Did we get the package down?
Not quite, said Zoe's dad, who never wanted anyone to feel like a failure.
Very close.
Zoe looked around for something to throw up at the rafter. She picked up a 3/4 full bottle of water, held it in the palm of her hand, and took aim. She hit the package straight on. It fell into Ben's hands.
Nice shot.
He handed it to her.
Thanks,
she said.
Open it,
instructed Jessica, as if Zoe had been intending to just look at it for a while. The package had that firm, soft consistency of something encased in bubble wrap. She fumbled with the masking tape and tore at the brown paper.
Careful, said her mother. It might be breakable.
Zoe pulled at the tape on the bubble wrap and was reminded of opening a birthday gift, surrounded by people at a party, all eyes on her and Zach. Tomorrow was their 21st birthday. It might be time to reclaim it. She thought that maybe, once they got back to Melbourne, she would tell her parents that she wanted to go to La Fattoria for pizza to celebrate her 21st. It felt suddenly as if it might be possible to do some of the things they'd stopped doing after Zach died. It wouldn't be the same without him. It would never be the same. But it felt possible. She would still take off the olives and leave them along the edge of her plate for Zach. And now she really, really felt like pizza. Her mouth watered at the thought of pepperoni. She would never take pepperoni for granted again. She unrolled the bubble wrap. Inside was a small hand-painted wooden doll of a little girl wearing a scarf around her head and an apron around her waist. She had red circles on her cheeks and quizzically angled eyebrows. She seemed to be saying to Zoe, hello? Zoe turned it around and held it upside down. It's a Russian doll, said her mother.
Oh, right.
Zoe twisted the top and bottom halves of the doll in opposite directions to reveal the smaller doll inside. She handed the halves to her mother and opened the next doll. Within moments, there was a row of 5 dolls of increasingly smaller sizes on the floor between them.
Wait, is that the last one? Said Carmel. It's empty. Normally there is a tiny final doll that you can't open.
No message, said Frances. I thought the security code would be inside the last one.
So what the hell does that mean then? Said Ben.
I don't know. Zoe tried to suppress a yawn. She was all at once exhausted. She longed for her own bed, for her phone, for pizza. For all this to be over.
Okay, this is really starting to piss me off now, said Lars.
Chapter 59. Marcia. Marcia saw Yao's smile of relief fade from his face as he watched the screen.
But wait, why isn't the code in the doll?
He turned to Marcia. The plan was to put the security code in the doll. Marcia lifted up the last tiny doll
from where it sat on her keyboard and held it between her fingertips. Yes, you're right. That was the original plan. So, but why isn't it there? Yao's eyebrows were drawn together, just like those of the doll. I had an epiphany, said Masha, while I was meditating. Suddenly, I knew what needed to be done in order for them to achieve true transformation after their psychedelic experiences. This, what is happening to these 9 people right now, is quite literally a koan. It is a koan in practice. He must surely see the brilliance of it. Yao stared at her without comprehension. A koan is a paradox that leads to enlightenment, said Masha. A koan demonstrates the inadequacy of their logical thinking. I know what a koan is, said Yao slowly. Once they surrender and accept that there is no solution, well, then they will be free. That is the central paradox of this koan, said Masha. The solution is no solution. The solution is no solution, repeated Yao. Exactly. Do you remember this koan? A master who lived as a hermit on a mountain was asked by a man, what is the way? And the master said, what a fine mountain this is. The man felt frustrated. He said, I am not asking you about the mountain, but about the way. The master said, so long as you cannot go beyond the mountain, my son, you cannot reach the way. So in this case, the mountain is the security door? Take detailed notes, said Masha impatiently. She pointed at the screen and at his notepad. Don't forget, this is very important for the book we will write. They've been in there for too long, said Yao. They're hungry and tired. They are going to lose their minds. Exactly, said Masha. She herself had not eaten now for more days than she could remember, and she had not slept since the night before the therapy sessions. She touched Yao lightly in the center of his chest with her finger. She knew the power of her touch on him. She had not yet fully exploited that power, but she would, if necessary. Exactly. They must lose their minds. You know this. The self is an illusion. The self does not exist. Sure. Okay, said Biao. But, Masha, they must surrender, said Masha. I think they're going to report us to the police, said Yao. Masha laughed. Remember the Rumi quote, Yao? Out beyond the idea of wrongdoing and right doing, there is a field. I'll meet you there. Isn't that beautiful? I don't think the justice system is interested in fields, said Yao. We can't give up on them, Yao, Masha gestured at the screen. They have all come so far. So, how long are you planning on keeping them locked up?
Yao's voice sounded thin and strained, as if he'd become an old man.
"That's not the right question," said Marcia tenderly, her eyes on the computer monitor as some of the guests gathered around the door to the studio. They were taking it in turns to punch in different combinations of numbers. Lars punched the door with his fist, like a spoiled child.
"I think I should let them out now," said Yao. "They must open that door themselves," she said.
"They can't," said Yao. "They can," said Marcia.
She thought about the sunny Australian lives these people had been handed at birth. They had only ever known supermarket shelves that overflowed with choice. They had never seen an empty grocery store with nothing but boxes of Indian tea. They did not need attributes like ingenuity or resourcefulness. The clock struck 5, and they turned off their computers and went to the beach because they did not have 100 university-educated candidates all too willing to take their job off their hands.
"Oh, yes, I did that for you two tickets once," an Australian woman at Marcia's work had said when Marcia described the horrendous queues that lasted for days at the embassies, and how she and her husband took turns to wait. And Marcia had said, "Yes, very much the same."
She remembered how, when they were right in the middle of the application process, her husband received a card in the mail to report to the KGB office.
"It will be fine," her husband said. "Do not worry."
It was like he was already an Australian, the phrase, "no worries," built into his psyche before he even knew the words. But in the Soviet era, people had received those cards and never come back. When Marcia dropped him off outside that tall, gray building, he kissed her and said, "Go home." But she didn't go home. She sat in that car for 5 hours, the simmering terror in her heart misting up the windows, and she would never forget the relief that detonated through her body when she saw him walking down the street towards her, grinning like a boy on an Australian beach. Only a few months later, she and her husband stood at the airport with American dollars hidden in their socks while a sneering customs office upturned the entire contents of their carefully packed suitcases because they were traitors betraying their country by leaving. And her grandmother's necklace broke and beads scattered like pieces of her heart. Only those who have feared they will lose everything feel true gratitude for their lucky lives. "We must terrify them," she told Yao. "That is what they need."
"Terrify them?" said Yao.
His voice quavered. He was probably tired and hungry himself.
"I don't think we should terrify our guests."
Marcia stood. He looked up at her, like her child, like her lover. She could feel the unbreakable spiritual connection between them. He would never defy her. "Tonight will be their dark night of the soul," she said.
"Dark night of the soul?"
A dark night of the soul is essential for rapid spiritual progress, said Marcia. "You've had your own dark night of the soul. I've had mine. We need to break them before we can make them whole again. You know this, Yao." She saw the flicker of doubt in his eyes. She stepped closer to him, so close that they were almost touching.
"Tomorrow they will be reborn," she said.
"I just don't know." Masha stepped closer still, and for the merest fraction of a second, she let her eyes drop to his lips. Let the darling boy think the impossible was possible.
"We are doing something extraordinary for these people, Yao," said Masha.
"I'm going to let them out," said Yao, but there was no conviction in his voice.
"No," said Masha.
She lifted her hand tenderly to his neck, careful not to reveal the silvery glint of the syringe.
"No, you're not."
Chapter 60. Frances. Frances twirled an empty water bottle on her finger, round and round, until it flew off and skittered across the floor. "Stop that," said Carmel severely, and Frances could tell that was the voice Carmel used when one of her little girls was being annoying. "Sorry," she said at the same time as Carmel said, "Sorry." It was, according to Napoleon's watch, 9 p.m. They had been in here now for just over 30 hours. They hadn't eaten for over 48 hours. People had begun complaining of headaches, lightheadedness, fatigue, and nausea. Waves of irritability swept the room at intervals. People bickered, then apologized, then snapped again. Voices quivered with emotion and skidded into hysterical laughter. Some people drifted off to sleep and then woke with a loud gasp. Napoleon was the only one who stayed consistently calm. It felt like he was their unofficially appointed leader, even though he wasn't issuing any instructions. "Don't drink too much water," Heather had told Frances when she'd seen her returning from the bathroom after filling her water bottle yet again. "Only drink when you're thirsty. You can die from drinking too much water because you flush out all the salt in your system. You can go into cardiac arrest."
"Okay," said Frances resignedly. "Thank you." She'd thought drinking lots of water would stave off the hunger pangs, although she wasn't as hungry as she'd thought she would be. The desire for food had peaked just before they'd found the useless Russian doll package, and then gradually began to wane until it became more abstract. She felt like she needed something, but food didn't seem to be the answer. Her friend Ellen was a fan of intermittent fasting, and she'd told Frances that she always experienced feelings of euphoria. Frances didn't feel euphoric, but her mind felt scrubbed clean, clear and bright. Was that the drugs or the fasting? Whatever it was, the clarity was an illusion, because she was having difficulty differentiating what had and hadn't happened since she'd got here. Did she dream of her nosebleed in the pool? She hadn't really seen her dad last night, had she? Of course she hadn't. Yet the memory of talking with her father felt more vivid than her memory of the nosebleed in the pool. How could that be? Time slowed and slowed. Slowed to a point that was so slow. It was unsustainable. Soon time would stop, literally stop, and they would all be trapped in a single moment forever. That didn't seem too fantastical a thought after last night's smoothie experience, when time had elongated and contracted over and over, like a piece of elastic being stretched and released. There was a long, heated discussion about when and if they should turn the lights out. It had not occurred to Francis that there was no natural light down here. It was Napoleon who'd figured it out. He'd been the one to find the light switch this morning when he woke up. He said he'd crawled around the room on his hands and knees and run his hands around the walls until he found it. When he flicked the switch to demonstrate for them, the room was plunged into a thick, impenetrable darkness that felt like death. Frances voted for the lights to go off at midnight. She wanted to sleep. Sleeping would pass the time, and she knew she'd never sleep with those blazing down lights. Others thought that they shouldn't risk sleeping. They should be ready to take action. Who knows what they're planning next? Jessica shot a hostile look at the camera. At some point, she had scrubbed off all her makeup. She looked 10 years younger. Younger even than Zoe. Too young to be pregnant. Too young to be wealthy. Without the makeup, the cosmetic enhancements looked like acne. A teenage blight that would pass when she grew up. I don't think anything sinister is going to happen in the middle of the night, Carmel said. We were woken up for the starlight meditation, said Heather. It's entirely possible. I liked the starlight meditation, said Carmel. Heather sighed. Carmel, you really need to kind of reframe your thinking about what's going on here. I vote for lights off, said Francis in a low voice. Napoleon had showed them where the microphones were installed in the corners of the room. He'd told them all, in whispers, that if they wanted to share something they didn't want heard, they should sit in the center of their room with their backs to the camera and keep their voices as low as possible. I think we should give Marcia the impression of total acceptance. I agree, whispered Zoe. She's exactly like my Year 11 maths teacher. You always had to let her think she'd won.
I'd prefer lights on, said Tony. We're at a disadvantage if we can't see. In the end, there were more in favour of lights on. So here they all sat, lights on. Occasional low murmurs of conversation like you'd hear in a library or a doctor's waiting room. Long periods of silence. Frances's body kept twitching, and then she would remember that there was no book to pick up, no movie to switch on, or bedside lamp to switch off. Sometimes she'd be almost on her feet before she realized that the decisive thing she was planning on doing was leaving the room. Her subconscious refused to accept her incarceration. Carmel came and sat next to Frances. Do you think we've gone into ketosis yet? She asked.
What's ketosis? Asked Frances. She knew perfectly well what it was.
It's where your body starts to burn fat because you don't need to lose weight, interrupted Frances. She tried not to snap, but she had not been thinking about food, and now she was.
I used to be thinner, said Carmel. She stretched her perfectly normal legs out in front of her.
We all used to be thinner, sighed Frances.
Last night, I hallucinated that I didn't have a body, said Carmel. I feel like there was maybe a message my subconscious was trying to give me.
It's so obscure. What could that message possibly be?
Mused Frances.
Carmel laughed. I know. She grabbed the flesh on her stomach and squeezed. I'm stuck in this cycle of self-loathing.
What did you do before you had children? Asked Frances. She wanted to know if there was more to Carmel than just hating her body and having four children. Early in Frances's career, a friend had complained that the mothers in her books were too one-dimensional, and Frances had thought secretly, don't they only have one dimension? She'd tried to give them more depth after that. She even gave them the leading roles, although it was hard to know where to put the children while their mothers were falling in love. When her editorial notes came back, Jo had written all over the margins, Who is looking after the kids? Frances had to go back through the manuscript and make babysitting arrangements. It was annoying. Private equity, said Carmel.
Goodness. Frances wouldn't have picked that. She wasn't even quite sure what it meant.
How were they going to find a middle ground between private equity and romance?
Did you like it? Surely that was safe.
Loved it, said Carmel. Loved it. It was a long time ago now, of course. Now I've got a part-time entry-level job, which is basically just data entry, to try to keep the cash coming in. But back then, I was a kind of a high flyer, or on my way to becoming one. I worked long hours, I'd get up at 5 every day and swim laps before work, and I ate whatever the hell I wanted, and I found women who talked about their weight excruciatingly boring.
Frances smiled.
I know. And then I got married and had kids, and I got totally swallowed up by this mum persona. We were only meant to have two, but my husband wanted a son, so we kept trying, and I ended up with 4 girls. And then, out of the blue, my husband said he wasn't attracted to me anymore, and he left.
Frances said nothing for a moment as she considered the particular cruelty of this kind of all-too-common midlife breakup and how it crushed a woman's self-worth.
Were you still attracted to him?
Carmel thought about it.
Some days. She put her thumb to the empty spot on her ring finger. I still loved him. I know I did, because some days I'd think, oh, what a relief. I still love him. It would be so inconvenient if I didn't love him.
Frances thought of all the things she could say. You'll meet someone else. You don't need a man to complete you. Your body does not define you. You need to fall in love with you.
Let's talk about something other than men, Carmel, before we fail the Bechdel test.
She said, You know what? I think you are most definitely in ketosis.
Carmel smiled. And at that moment, the room went dark.
Chapter 61. Napoleon.
Who turned the lights out?
It was his angriest teacher voice.
The one that got even the worst-behaved boy in a class to sit down and shut up. They had agreed the lights would stay on.
Not me.
Not me.
Not me.
The voices came from all around the room. The darkness was so complete, Napoleon instantly lost all sense of up and down. He held out his hands in front of him blindly, like he'd done this morning.
Is that you?
It was Heather's voice. She'd been sitting next to him. He felt her hand take his.
Yes. Where's Zoe?
I'm here, Dad.
Her voice came from the other side of the room. None of us was near the light switch, said Tony. Napoleon felt the rapid beat of his heart and took pleasure in his fear. It was a respite from the grey feeling that descended upon him the moment he woke up this morning. A thick fog had spread its soft fingers throughout his brain, his heart, his body, weighing him down so that it was an effort to speak, to lift his head, to walk. He was trying to pretend he was fine. He was fighting the fog with all his strength, trying to behave normally, to trick himself into getting better. It might be temporary. It might be just for today. Like a hangover. Tomorrow, perhaps, he would wake up and be himself again.
Maybe Marcia is telling us it's time to go to sleep now.
It was Frances. He recognized her light, dry voice in the darkness. Before last night, Napoleon would have said that he and Frances had similar personalities, in that they shared a certain base level of optimism. But not now. Now, all his hope had drained away. It had seeped out of him and evaporated like sweat, leaving him empty and spent.
I'm not tired, said Lars, or maybe Ben.
This is fucked.
That was Ben, or maybe Lars.
I think Marcia is about to do something, said Jessica.
He was pretty sure. She sounded more intelligent when you couldn't see her face. There was a moment of silence. Napoleon kept waiting for his eyes to adjust, but they didn't. No figures emerged. The dark seemed to get darker.
It's a bit creepy, said Zoe, with a tremor in her voice, and Napoleon and Heather both moved reflexively, as if they could make their way through the darkness to get to her.
It's just dark. We're all here. You're safe. That was definitely Smiley Hogburn, comforting Zoe. Napoleon wished he could tell someone that he'd kind of played football with Smiley Hogburn. He realized the person he wished he could tell was himself, the self who no longer existed. The darkness settled. It was creepy.
Maybe Lars should sing, said Frances.
At last, some appreciation for my talent, said Lars.
We should all sing, said Carmel.
No thanks, said Jessica.
You and me, Carmel, said Lars.
He began to sing, I Can See Clearly Now, and Carmel joined in.
She could sing beautifully. What a surprise to hear her voice rise in the darkness like that, holding the melody with such grace. How people could surprise you. Napoleon had thought when he woke this morning that the feeling that permeated his body must be anger, because he had the right to be incandescent with anger at his wife for what she had concealed from him, and what she had chosen to finally reveal in the most nightmarish of settings. As his mind had struggled to separate ghastly fiction from reality. Although now he thought he was free of the drugs, he did not have any doubt about what had and hadn't really happened. He'd dreamed of Zack, but he hadn't dreamed Heather's revelation. He didn't remember asking her about the side effects of the asthma medication, and yet he could imagine exactly how she would have replied, with unconcealed impatience, because she was the one in their family in charge of all decisions relating to health. Heather had the medical training. He was the teacher. He was in charge of homework. She was in charge of medication. She took pride in not questioning his decisions about education, although he would happily have been questioned by her. He was always eager for a debate, but she just wanted to get things ticked off the list. She liked to think of herself as the efficient, no-nonsense one in their relationship, the one who got things done. "Well, look what you got done, Heather." She was right when she said that, given the opportunity, he would have read the leaflet that came with the medication. And yes, Napoleon would have monitored Zack, and he would have told him. He would have said, "This might affect your mood, Zack. You need to watch out for it and let me know." And Zack would have rolled his eyes and said, "I never get any of those side effects, Dad." He could have. He would have. He should have. He might have saved him. Every day for 3 years, Napoleon had woken up each morning and thought, "Why?" And Heather knew why, or could take an educated guess at one possibility of why. And she had deliberately denied him the comfort of her knowledge because of her guilt. Did she not trust his love? Did she think he would have blamed her? Left her? Not only that, they had an obligation to make this known, to let the authorities know that this had happened. My God, there could be other children dying. They needed to make the community aware that those side effects should be taken seriously. It was incredibly selfish of Heather to have kept this to herself, to have protected herself at the risk of others. He would call Dr. Chang as soon as he got out of here. And Zoe, his darling girl, the only one to see that something wasn't right because she knew Zack best. All she needed to say was, "Dad, something is wrong with Zack." And Napoleon would have acted because he knew how dangerous a boy's feelings could be. He could have. He would have. He should have. He might have saved him. They'd had conversations about depression around the dinner table. Napoleon knew all the conversations you were meant to have with your kids, and he made sure they had those conversations. Don't give out your personal details on the internet. Never get in the car with a driver who's been drinking. Call us at any time of the night. Tell us how you feel. Tell us if you're being bullied. We can fix things. We promise we can fix things. Am I angry? He had been asking himself that question all day, wondering if the fog was just anger masquerading as something else. But the feeling that had infiltrated all the cells of his body was something far more and something far less than anger. It was a dull nothingness, with the weight and texture of wet cement. As he sat there, lost in the darkness, listening to Carmel sing, as Lars lowered his voice and let her take the song, it occurred to him, maybe this was how Zack felt. Whether the asthma medication caused it, or whether it was teenage hormones run amok, or a combination of both, maybe this was how it felt. Like his mind, body, and soul were shrouded in grey fog. Like there was not much point to anything at all. Like you could act and look exactly the same on the outside, but on the inside, everything was different. Oh, mate, you were just a kid, and I'm a man, and it's been less than a day, and already I just want it to end. He saw his son's face, the first rough greys of stubble, the curve of his eyelashes when he looked down, avoiding eye contact. He could never meet his father's eyes when he'd done something wrong. He hated to be in trouble, and the poor kid was always in trouble. Zoe was smarter. She could twist her narrative to make it appear she'd done the right thing. It looked like girls were controlled by their feelings, but the opposite was true. Girls had excellent control of their feelings. They spun them around like battens. Now I'm crying. Now I'm laughing. Who knows what I'll do next? Not you. A boy's emotions were like baseball bats that blindsided him. At that moment, that morning 3 years ago, Zack didn't make a bad choice. He made what to him must have felt like the only choice. What else could you do when you felt like this? It was like asking those people in the burning towers not to jump. What else could you do if you couldn't breathe? You would do anything to breathe, anything at all. Of course you jump. Of course you do. He saw his boy looking at him with eyes pleading for understanding. Zack was such a good kid. Of course, Napoleon did not accept or condone the kid's decision. It was the wrong decision. It was a stupid decision, the worst decision. But for the first time ever, he felt he might understand how he came to make it. He imagined taking him onto his lap, the way he'd once done when he was a little boy, holding him close, whispering into his ear. You're not in trouble, Zack. I'm so sorry for yelling at you. I understand now, son. You're not in trouble, mate. You're not in trouble. You're not in trouble. Napoleon? Said Heather. He was squeezing her hand too tightly. He loosened his grip. A black and white image flickered on the screen above their heads. Carmel broke off her singing. What the hell? Said Lars. Marcia's voice boomed at a volume that made Napoleon's ears throb. Her face filled the screen. She smiled at them, radiant with love. Good evening, my sweetie pies, my lapochki. My God, said Heather under her breath. Chapter 62. Frances. She's mad. She's crazy. She's nuts. She's unhinged. It had all been a joke before. What Francis really meant was that Marcia was odd, alternative, intense, excessively tall and exotic and different in every way from Francis. She hadn't truly questioned Marcia's state of mind. Part of her had wondered if Marcia was a genius. Didn't all geniuses seem mad to mere mortals? Even the drugs hadn't truly concerned her. The fact was that if Marcia had asked, "Would you like to try this smoothie laced with LSD?" Francis might have said, "Sure, why not?" She would have been impressed by all the talk about research, comforted by Yao's background as a paramedic, and intrigued by the possibility of a transcendent experience. And she would have been especially susceptible if someone else had said yes first. As a teenager, her mother had once said to her, "If all your friends jumped off a cliff, would you jump too?" Frances had answered without guile, "Of course." But now, sitting here in the dark, watching Marcia's image on the screen, it was clear. Marcia was not quite right. Her green eyes shone with an evangelical fervor that would not respond to logic or sense. "Congratulations to all of you," she said. "I am so pleased with your progress. You have all come so far from day one." She clasped her hands together like an actress accepting an Oscar. "Your journeys are nearly complete." The screen lit up the room in ghostly patches of light so that Francis could see everyone's faces as they all stared up at Marcia. "You need to let us out of here," shouted Jessica. "Can she hear us?" asked Carmel uncertainly.
"No need to shout, Jessica. Hello there, Carmel. I can see you. I can hear you," said Marcia. "The magic of technology. Isn't it amazing?"
Her eyes looked off-center at the camera. It made it easier not to succumb to her madness.
"I was so happy when you solved the escape puzzle and found the Matryoshka," said Marcia.
"But we didn't solve it," said Frances. She was personally offended by this. "We're still here. There was no damned code in the doll."
"Exactly," said Marcia. "Exactly."
"What?" said Francis.
"You worked as a team, though not quite to the extent I'd hoped. I assumed you would build a human pyramid to reach the doll, all of you, rather than playing football."
Her lip lifted in a sneer on the word football. Francis felt defensive of Tony.
"When I was at school in Serov many years ago, we made a human pyramid that was quite remarkable. I have never forgotten it."
Her eyes lost their focus, and then she snapped back.
"Anyway, that does not matter. You got there in the end. You found the doll, and here we are."
"The doll told us nothing," said Jessica. "It was empty."
"That's right, Jessica," said Marcia patiently,
as if to a small child who does not understand the way the world works.
"She's not making any sense," muttered Ben.
"What I'd find truly transformative right now is a long hot shower," said Lars. He smiled up at Marcia with the full force of his gorgeous face.
It was like he was holding a glowing lightsaber up to the screen. Francis would bet that smile had opened many doors before. But not this one. Marcia just smiled back. It was an epic battle of beauty and charisma. Lars held on for as long as he could before he surrendered. His smile vanished. "For God's sake, I just want to get out of here, Marcia."
"Ah, Lars," said Marcia, "you need to remember what Buddha said. Nothing is forever except change."
"This already feels like forever, Marcia." Marcia chuckled. "I know you like your solitude, Lars. It is hard to find yourself having to interact with strangers all day long, yes?"
"Everyone is very nice," said Lars. "That's not really the point."
"We just want to go back to our rooms," said Heather. She sounded quite meek and reasonable. "The psychedelic therapy was wonderful, thank you, but..."
"It was wonderful, was it? You have changed your tune then, Heather."
A fine thread of aggression ran through Marcia's words.
"I hope you speak from the heart. I heard talk of reporting me to the police. I must confess that was hurtful to me."
"I was upset," said Heather. "As you know, today is the anniversary of my son's death. I wasn't thinking straight."
"Now I understand." She looked up at the screen with what appeared to be complete acquiescence. It was inspiring to see.
"We all understand," continued Heather. "We're so grateful for what you've done for us. We would never have had this opportunity in our normal lives. But now we'd just like to go back to our rooms and enjoy the rest of the retreat."
Frances tried to put herself in Marcia's position. It came to her that Marcia considered herself an artist. And, like any artist, she craved praise. She simply wanted recognition, respect, 5-star reviews, gratitude.
"I think I speak for all of us when I say this has been an incredible experience," she began. But she was interrupted by Tony.
"Is that Yao behind you?"
He was on his feet, his eyes on the screen.
"Is he all right?"
"Yao is here, yes," said Marcia.
She moved to one side of her computer screen and gestured graciously like a model on a game show, indicating the prize. The prize was Yao. He was slumped forward in Marcia's chair, asleep or unconscious on Marcia's desk, one cheek squashed flat while his arms formed a semicircle around his head.
"Is he breathing? What's wrong with him?"
Heather also stood and moved to a position beneath the television screen. She dropped the fake acquiescent tone.
"What has he taken? What have you given him? Is he alive?" asked Francis in panic.
"He is just napping," said Marcia. "He is so tired. He has been up all night, working hard for you."
She caressed Yao's hair and pointed at something they couldn't see on his scalp.
"That is Yao's birthmark. I saw it during my near-death experience."
She smiled back at the camera, and Francis shivered.
That is when I came face to face with my own mortality in the most remarkable and wonderful way. Her eyes shone. This evening, you too will face your mortality. Sadly, I can't give you the privilege of looking death directly in the eyes, but I can give you a glance, a glimpse, an unforgettable glimpse that will... She searched for the right word and found it with obvious satisfaction. That will amalgamate all your experiences so far. The silence, the psychedelic therapy, the escape puzzle.
He doesn't look like he's napping, said Heather. Have you given him something?
Ah, Heather, said Marcia, you are practically a doctor, aren't you? But I can assure you, Yao is simply napping.
Where's Delilah? Asked Ben.
Delilah is no longer with us, said Marcia.
What do you mean, no longer with us? Said Ben. What does that mean?
She has left us, said Marcia airily.
Of her own accord? Asked Francis.
She thought about the other Tranquillum house staff, the lovely smiley chef who brought out the food. Jan, with her miraculous healing hands. Where were they while the guests were locked up and Yao lay unconscious on Marcia's desk?
I need you all to listen carefully, said Marcia, ignoring Francis's question about Delilah.
She moved to the front of the camera again so that Yao's body was concealed. We are now going to play a fun icebreaker.
I feel like the ice is well and truly broken, Marcia, said Lars. Buddha said that we must radiate boundless love towards the entire world. And that's what this exercise is all about. It's about love. It's about passion. It's about getting to know each other, said Marcia. I call it death sentence.
She looked at them expectantly, as if waiting for an enthusiastic eruption of questions and comments.
Nobody moved. You like the name?
Said Marcia, lowering her head and lifting her eyes in a way that could almost be considered flirtatious.
I do not like the name, said Napoleon.
Ah, Napoleon, I like you. You are an honest man. Now, let me explain how this activity works, said Marcia. Imagine this. You have all of you been sentenced to death. You are on death row. Maybe that would have been a better name. Death row. She frowned. I think that is better. We will call it death row.
Carmel began to weep softly. Frances put her hand on her arm.
So, how does this game, death row, work? Let me explain. If you are sentenced to death, what happens? You need someone to argue on your behalf, don't you? To argue for clemency, for a stay of execution. Obviously, that person is your...
Marcia raised encouraging eyebrows.
Lawyer?
Finished Jessica.
Yes, cried Marcia. Your lawyer who defends you. The person who says to the judge, no, this person does not deserve to die. This is a good person, Your Honor.
an upstanding member of the community with so much to offer.
You see what I'm saying? So, you are all lawyers, and you each have a client. You understand?
Nobody spoke.
I have assigned your clients. Let me read out the names to you.
She held up a piece of notepaper and read out, Francis defends Lars. Lars defends Ben.
She looked up at them. You're listening? I will only say this once.
We're listening, said Napoleon.
Heather defends Francis. Tony defends Carmel. Carmel defends Zoe. Zoe defends Jessica. Jessica defends Heather. Ben defends Napoleon. And,
she took an exaggerated breath,
Napoleon defends Tony.
Phew! That's all of you. She looked up from the paper.
Do you all know who you are defending?
Nobody answered. They all looked dumbly back at the screen.
Tony, who are you defending? Asked Marcia.
Carmel, said Tony evenly,
and Zoe, what about you?
I'm defending Jessica, said Zoe. I don't really understand what crime she's committed.
The crime is not relevant. We've all committed crimes, Zoe, said Marcia. I think you know that. No one is innocent.
You're a psychotic, so presumably you are the judge, Marcia?
Napoleon spoke loudly over the top of his wife. That's right. I will be the judge, said Marcia. You will each have just 5 minutes to defend your client. It's not long, but it's long enough. Don't waste time with waffle. Make sure that every word packs a punch.
She curled her hand into a fist.
You'll have the night to prepare. Presentations will be at dawn. You must ask yourself, why does my client deserve to live?
Because everyone deserves to live, said Tony.
But why your client in particular? Let's say there is only one parachute left. Only one place left in the lifeboat. Why should your client take that parachute over someone else? Said Marcia.
Then it's women and children first, said Tony.
But what if you are all the same gender? All the same age. Who lives? Who dies? Said Marcia.
Is the game called Last Parachute now? Said Lars, his face hard with bitter mockery. So we're all going to sit around and discuss ethical dilemmas like first-year philosophy students? While Yao lies there comatose on your desk?
Wonderful. This is all just so transformative.
Careful, said Tony under his breath.
This is an important exercise, shouted Marcia.
The tendons on her neck were rigid with rage. Frances felt sick. She was going to lose this game. She always performed poorly in these kinds of activities, and now her client, Lars, had already got the judge offside. Ben spoke up in a placatory manner.
So, could you just explain, please, Marcia, what happens if, according to you, our judge,
we don't successfully defend our clients.
Marcia breathed in deeply through her nostrils.
Well, obviously we don't generally execute our guests. That's not good for business.
She laughed gaily. So this is all just hypothetical? Said Ben.
That's enough questions!
Screamed Marcia so loudly that Carmel took a step back and landed quite hard on Francis's toe.
This is totally loot, began Heather.
Napoleon grabbed her arm.
We're all going to take part in the exercise, Marcia,
he said loudly.
It sounds very stimulating.
Marcia nodded graciously.
Good. You're going to find it transformative, Napoleon. You really are. Now I must give you light for this enlightening exercise.
She reached out her hand and the lights came back on, causing everyone to blink and stare dazedly at each other.
Once we've defended our clients, will you let us out?
Asked Carmel, rubbing her eyes, her voice hoarse.
You're asking the wrong questions, Carmel, said Marcia. Only you can set yourself free. Remember, I talked to you just a few days ago about impermanence. Nothing lasts forever. Do not cling to happiness or suffering.
I just really want to go home right now, said Carmel.
Marcia clucked sympathetically.
Spiritual awakenings are rarely easy, Carmel.
Francis raised a hand.
I need a pen. I can't prepare a presentation if I can't write it down.
She patted the empty pockets of her sweatpants.
I have nothing to write with.
Marcia behaved as if Francis hadn't spoken.
Now, my sweetie pies, I wish you the best of luck. I shall be back at dawn. Remember to focus your thoughts. Ask the right questions of your clients and listen with your heart. Convince me why each of you deserves to live.
She looked fondly at Yao, as if he were her sleeping child, patted his head and then looked back at the screen.
Let me leave you with these words. Ardently, do today what must be done. Who knows? Tomorrow, death comes. The Buddha.
She put her hands together in prayer and lowered her head.
Namaste.